Well, hey, good morning. It's good to see you. We are in week four of our series that we are calling Soul Searching. And we're excited. If you've been tracking with us the last few weeks, we've been talking about that part of us that makes us us. When we're talking about the soul, what I'm talking about is what makes you you. We have all kinds of different parts of us, our physical parts, our emotional parts, our mental parts. But there's something that I believe brings all those parts together that gives us our identity, something that makes us us, something that makes us human. In the deepest sense. And that's what we've been calling the soul. And we've been talking in this series about how we want to make sure that our souls are healthy. We want to have those checks and balances to look at our lives and not just say, how are you doing on the surface? But how are you doing way deep down? How are you doing? And today I want to address a myth that all of us believe, but none of us believe. And it's important because I think it speaks to our soul and how we pursue health of ourselves. It speaks to our appetites and the desires that we have. And this is the myth. The myth is that if I get what I want, I will be satisfied, right? This is one of those things we talk about that on the one hand, none of us believe. So if I came to you and I said, hey, do you think you'll be happy if you just get more stuff? I know you feel like you want more stuff. You have that desire. If you get it, do you think you'll be happy? If you get the promotion, do you think for the rest of your life, you're going to be happy that that's the last desire that you're going to have that's unfulfilled? And once it's fulfilled, you're going to be happy. And most of us say, well, no, I know that's not how it works. I know that life isn't all about material possessions or success or achievement or whatever it is that I feel like I desire. I know that that isn't ultimately what leads to satisfaction because I've tried that, because I've experienced it, and sometimes I felt the satisfaction, but it's been kind of short-lived. It's come and then it's gone. For a short time, I felt like, yes, I've got what I needed, what I wanted, and then it kind of fades away. But we all do believe this. At least functionally, we believe it, right? No, it's not about the stuff that I need that's going to bring me real satisfaction. And then we go out into the parking lot and we see somebody driving a nicer car than us, and we go, man, that would feel good to drive that car. We go home and we start flipping through the IKEA catalog and we go, oh, if my house looked like this. And then we start thinking about our house and we go online and we look at all the houses that are for sale. And we thought, if I could get into that neighborhood and that echelon, if I could get there, oh, that would feel good. And we have these desires. And the more we think about them, the more we feed them, the stronger they become. And we might say, when we see a statement like that, I know that's not how it works. Not really. But functionally, those are some of the things that we pursue. Those are some of the things that we think about. You know, we live in a culture that spurs us on to do that, a culture that says, if you have a desire, fulfill it, fulfill it, fulfill it. Go for more, go for more, go for more. It's going to lead to happiness. You're going to get there. Just have a little more. Pursue a little bit more. Take a little bit more. So we overeat. We overmedicate. Right? These are things that when we have feelings of inadequacy, feelings of sadness, feelings of need, there's certain things in our life that we go for and we try and eliminate those feelings. And for some of us, we go right to food. Even when we're not really physically hungry, it's just there's this comfort thing and we go, I need more food, I need more food, I need more food. You ever notice that? Some of us, it's over-medicate. It's not just the appropriate amount of medication for something that we need medication for, but we go to substances because we should have these desires. We don't want to feel that anymore. Want to fulfill that somehow. Some of us do something called retail therapy, right? It's therapy. This is going to make me feel better. This is going to get something off my chest. This is going to, right? Therapy. It leads me to a more healthy place. How am I going to do that? I'm going to take my credit card, go to the mall. I'm going to buy a bunch of stuff and I'm going to feel so good about it. And we binge watch because we can't watch TV anymore. We have to binge watch TV. And that's encouraged in our binge watching. Nobody thinks that's a bad thing. It's, hey, I'm binge watching this show or that show. Of course I am. And Netflix gives it right to us. We don't have to go and pick the next episode. It's just, hey, 15 more seconds. This bad boy's starting. Run to the fridge, get your snack, fulfill that desire, come back and binge watch. Keep going, keep going, keep going. It's going to feel good. You got to find out the next thing that's happening. You got to fulfill those desires. And there's a couple of things that actually people have studied about our brains and how this works. And there's probably a whole bunch of things, but a couple of them stand out to me about how this actually works in our brains and how our brains work. One of them is called an impact bias. That's the tendency for people to overestimate the length or the intensity of future feeling states. It means that we get something in our mind that we want, And it just, the satisfaction that we think it's going to bring is so intensified over what it's actually going to bring that it becomes like this, I got to have it. We think it's going to solve all our problems. It's going to fulfill our innermost desires. That is the thing. And the impact bias tells us that this thing that really, if we thought about it long enough, we would know, you know, yeah, that's going to make me feel good for a while. And then that feeling's going to wear off and it's going to become kind of normal. But impact bias says, no. This is going to give you lasting satisfaction. It's going to be so, so great. Yesterday, I drove past this sign for people selling houses. It's one of those housing developments that they're putting up. And there's this big sign with this big picture on it selling the houses. You know what the picture was? It was this woman sitting in a chair reading a book. Close up. There was no house, inside or outside, in the entire picture. Because our culture doesn't sell us houses. It doesn't sell us cars. It doesn't sell us stuff. It sells us satisfaction. This is going to make you someone who can sit peacefully and read a book. Just buy the house. Yeah, okay, well, I'll go to the mortgage broker. Let's do this. I don't care what it costs. And another one is focalism. Excuse me, focalism focuses our mind on one thing and blurs everything out. Sometimes this is used in negotiating tactics, and it's called anchoring. It kind of means that oftentimes the very first piece of information you get, the person who puts the first thing out there, becomes this anchor that all of a sudden you focus on, that you kind of gauge everything else based on that first thing that you see or are told, the first piece of information. And often that first piece of information gets disproportionate weight. It happens when you can't stop thinking about what it is that you want, whether that's a certain kind of relationships, money, possessions, success, approval, whatever else it is. Our attention starts to focus so strongly on that one thing that we get lost in it. And sometimes we even fail to realize how much we're actually making out of things that can never really, on that deep level, come through for us. We focus, 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 trying to fulfill those desires. One of the greatest philosophers and social commentary of my adolescence, Jerry Seinfeld, once said, speaking of appetites, he said, you know, when you're a kid and everybody tells you how bad it is that you're going to ruin your appetite, you hear it all the time. Your parents say, what are you eating? You're going to ruin your appetite. Don't eat that. You're going to ruin your appetite. Oh, you've ruined your appetite. He says, once I grew up, I realized I've got thousands of appetites. Who cares if I ruin one? I could ruin dozens. There's always another one coming behind it. And isn't that the truth? More appetites, more appetites, more appetites. And we fulfill one and there's another one coming around. We ruin one. We satisfy one, and there's just another appetite, another desire, something else that we want, something else that makes us feel like we're just not there and we don't have what we want. And as we're talking in this series about our souls, I think this is one of the dangers to the health of our soul, is how we pursue our desire, because I believe that we all need satisfaction. We need deep, real soul satisfaction. So if you've ever been let down, or if you've ever feel like you're on that wheel of one appetite followed by another appetite and never quite getting there, if you're looking in life to find something deeper that meets your needs way deep down in who you are, I hope today will be helpful as we talk about that. And we're going to be in Psalm chapter 131. If you have a Bible or app on your phone, love for you to join me there. It's a short psalm. And we've been talking in this series about a number of different psalms because these are poetic works. They are people who have kind of from the inside just revealed themselves through poetry, as we do in poetry. They've just tried to dive deep into who they are in the human experience and express it in these powerful ways that really, for most of us, we're all going to identify somewhere in our lives with. So Psalm 131, there's a little heading that tells us a little bit about what the psalm is about, what the poem's about. It says, a song for pilgrims ascending to Jerusalem, a psalm of David. Psalm of David means it was either written by David or for David. We're not always sure. A song of pilgrims ascending to Jerusalem means this was a poem that was written for Israelite people when they made pilgrimages to Jerusalem to celebrate certain festivals at their temple in their capital city. It was a communal time, and there were three big pilgrim festivals that it meant wherever you're at, you got to try your best to get to come in community and to celebrate these kind of things. They were Passover, which is a celebration of the Exodus. We talk a lot about that. This amazing time where God took them from slaves in Egypt and freed them in this miraculous, miraculous show of power. And then Pentecost. Pentecost means 50 days after Passover. It's a harvest festival, kind of like we're coming up to Thanksgiving, that sort of thing. Be reminded that God provides for you and everything that you have, all your crops, all your animals, all that kind of stuff is God's gift to you. And so you remember how good he has been to you. And then Tabernacles is the third one. And Tabernacles, it speaks to the kind of little dwellings that the Israelites made after they left Egypt and they were wandering in the desert. They would make these dwelling places. And so they would celebrate, again, God's provision when they were in the desert, when they didn't have enough. And so really, these were opportunities, festivals, to renew their communal commitment to relying on God, to remember what God has done in the past, to remember that God does step into history, that God does do things on our behalf, that when things are hard and when you're struggling and when everything seems to be going against you, that God does show up. He's with you. He provides for you. He wants to be your great provider in all things, no matter how bleak it is. And that's what these festivals were about. We go to the temple. We all come together so that together we can remind each other that everything we have is God's gift to us. And God's been working in our history and our ancestors for decades and decades and centuries and centuries. And he's still working with us. Do you believe that today? Because for some of you, that may be the biggest takeaway this morning as you read the heading of this psalm and you just are reminded that God's for you and that God will show up in your life and God is showing up in your life. And that in spots where you may not feel that way, where you're struggling, where you have a lot of desires, things need to get better, maybe today will be a kind of pilgrimage for you to come back to a God who says, hey, I've been working in history and I'm still working in history. Let's come together as community and remind each other that God is with us. You don't believe it. You don't know if it's real. You know, today and every day for Christians, we remind ourselves of the cross that Jesus says, not only can I step into history, but I would step into history. I'd give my life for you to forgive you, to show you mercy, to show you grace, to sustain you, to provide for you every step of the way. Is that what you need to hear today? Is that how you need to celebrate Thanksgiving this upcoming week as you get there? Just go, yeah, that's what this is all about. That's why we come together. That's why we come together on Sunday. That's why we come together in a life group. It's why we do this over and over and over, and we don't stop doing it. We spur each other on to believe that. Maybe for you this morning, that's the first step, is just to believe that coming into community and being reminded that God is working on your behalf. That's just what you need today. And then here's another step. So we get into the first verse. And the author of the poem says, Lord, Yahweh, that's the most personal name that God has in all of Scripture for himself. Lord, my heart is not proud. My eyes are not haughty. I don't concern myself with matters too great or too awesome for me to grasp. Okay, this is important because this is a really short poem, but it sets up the second half of the poem to understand it. This is a declaration of humility, which is essentially saying, I don't always know what is best for me. This is what the psalmist is saying. Okay, I'm not proud. I'm not arrogant, haughty. I just know that sometimes I don't know. And where we're going to go with this poem in the next verse, it shows us a little bit of the context. What he's saying is that my desires are not always reliable gauges of need. Yeah, I want a lot of things. I desire a lot of things. But God, just up front, I want to come to you and say, I understand that you know better than I do. And my desires, what I want, is not always a good gauge of what I need. In fact, I might not know what I need. This might be the step that some of you are stuck on to go, hold on a second. Maybe I need to change my mindset and be willing to come before God and say, maybe I don't always know what I need. Maybe you've been stuck on something where you have thought, if this situation turns, if this relationship comes through, if this person in this relationship does this for me or reconciles this, or if I experience this, or if I go on this vacation, yes, then it's all going to come through. That's what I really need. And this almost just starts by going, you know what? There's a lot of things that I want, but maybe those things aren't the best gauge of what I really need. Are you willing to get there? Are you willing to be humble to say, man, there's some stuff. And listen, I'm not saying our desires are bad. In fact, most of our desires are really good desires. Most of the things that we want start with something good. We can blow them out of proportion. But that's what makes this so hard. It's not that we want really bad things and God says, no, you should want different things. It's that typically we want good things, but we want them out of proportion in a way that's not healthy for us sometimes. That's what makes this hard. So the psalmist starts by saying, all right, I'm gonna stop and humble myself. Maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm not sure. And then in verse 2, he says this, instead, I have calmed and quieted myself, like a weaned child who no longer cries for its mother's milk. Yes, like a weaned child is my soul within me. All right, this is one of the great joys of my job doing what I do. I am now going to explain breastfeeding to you. Now, I understand a couple of things. One is there's a whole group of you that know way more about this than I do. I get it. Just stay with me. We're going to stick to some basics. Second, I also get that in our culture, this is a triggering thing with people who have very strong opinions about it. That's cool. That's not where we're going with this either. So just stick with the imagery with me as I explain breastfeeding to you. The idea of weaning a child is essentially this. When children are first born, in order to properly nourish them with the nutrients that they need, we need a delivery system that works for them. We have a built-in one. I know we've got technology now and there's other stuff, but again, stay with the imagery. There's a built-in model. And so, mom often feeds their child. And the child grows to enjoy that a lot of the time. Well, there's exceptions, but they find physical sustenance. This is how they eat. They get their nutrients. But also, there's this comfort thing, and there's a bond that mothers and children, when they do this, just form with each other. And so over time, the baby, the child, gets really used to that, not just for food and nutrients, but also for comfort and for relational bonding with the mother. But there comes a time where you know this isn't supposed to go on forever. There comes a time where you know the goal is that this child is going to get bigger, they're going to grow up, they need to move on to other kinds of foods and nourishment. They need to get into solid foods one day. They need to be an adult, and this isn't going to work forever. So mothers, stop and realize that there's going to have to be an interruption in how this works. And so weaning is when the mother starts to pull away those feeds, sometimes one at a time. You know, the baby wants, they want the milk, but you say, you can't have the milk. And you kind of swap in something else that they can eat, and you distract them, and you do all kinds of things. And typically what happens is the babies don't like that. Because this is their food source. This is their source of comfort and bonding. And so sometimes kids go crazy. You take away feeding and they throw a temper tantrum. They throw a fit. This is what I want. This is what I need. But the parents know that while this is what the baby wants, it's not what they need long term. They need to have a step in the maturation process. They need to learn another food source. They need to learn something that's going to be able to satisfy what they need long term. And so this is part of the maturation. It's a positive step in the maturation of the child when they learn to move on to other food sources. But it's a tough thing for a lot of people. Again, because the baby's going to throw a tantrum, have a big stink, all that kind of stuff. Psalmist goes back. Instead, okay, I know most of us think we know what we want and that's what we need. But he said, instead, I calmed and quieted myself like a weaned child who no longer cries for its mother's. Yes, like a weaned child is my soul within me. So what he's saying is that my soul within me, I've realized in the maturation process that I got to move on, that I got to find another source of nourishment, another source of satisfaction. And this is part of maturing. This is a good part of life, to move on from this phase into something else. Some of us have experienced this, right? There's certain desires you have, certain comforts, certain luxuries, certain habits, certain things that are just the background of your life. They happen over and over and over. And when somebody threatens one of those things, when somebody's going to take one of those things away, one of those things that you run to for comfort and for sustenance in whatever phase of your life, emotionally or mentally, or, you know, in terms of your relationships or in terms of your job and what you need, when somebody threatens those, you throw a temper tantrum, just like a kid. Right? Sometimes it's your spouse and they just kind of push that button and say, maybe you're relying too much on this, and you get defensive or you get offensive, you get angry, you get depressed. Don't touch my wants and my needs and my desires. Those are the things that I need. And the psalmist goes, I've quieted myself. I've calmed myself. I've become like the child who is now weaned. And instead of throwing a temper tantrum, trying to get all of the things that I want, I've realized that maybe I need to mature, move on to something else, find something deeper. So here's the bottom line. Let's throw it up there. Bottom line, stop being such a baby. Come on. No, I'm kidding. Okay. That's not the bottom line. Here's the bottom line. Get control of your appetites, or your appetites will get control of you. This is how appetites work. They're like animals. The more you feed them, the stronger they get. And we think that the more we feed them, then we'll be satisfied. They'll go away, but they don't. The more you feed an appetite, the stronger it gets. And so instead, we need to learn to get in control of our appetites. We need to be like a child who is now weaned, and instead of throwing fits and saying, no, this is the only thing that I want, this is the only thing I need, to go, I'm moving on. I'm going to something deeper, something more profound. If you don't get control of your appetites will get control of you. They will run your life. You'll want more and more and more. You'll spend your entire life chasing those desires and trying to be fulfilled and never quite getting there. You already know that's true. That's where we started today. But functionally, we all fall back into this because our desires can be so strong. Again, they're often really good things, not bad things. But if our souls were created to connect with God and to other people in real, deep, meaningful relationship, as we've talked about the few weeks, that's what I believe, then deep satisfaction will come from roots that extend deeply into that relationship, and there find beauty and creativity and love. To appreciate the creator, not just things that are created. To drink from the source of satisfaction. To put things back into perspective. To trust in a God who justifies us, cares for us, loves us, sustains us, redeems us. A God who would give himself in love and die for us, to make sure that we knew that we are loved way deep down in our souls. The maturing process says that we extend our roots deep, deep down to get nourished from that. In fact, even gardeners will tell you that this is something that happens with plants, that there's a very real danger of overwatering plants. Because if you water them and water them and water them, they don't extend their roots. They don't grow their roots way deep down because there's always water available. And then when a drought comes, or when one or two days come where there isn't plentiful water, they don't have those deep roots that go way down deep and find a source of water. And so some gardeners will tell you with certain plants that you got to actually be careful, that you don't want to overwater them, because when drought comes, they won't be prepared. They're going to die. They're going to shrivel right away. Maybe the same is with us. Yeah, there's desire. Man, we love when everything's plentiful, when we have everything right at our fingertips, when we get everything that we want. But maybe we mature and grow deeper when we don't have everything we want, and those roots go further and further and further down to the source, to our creator, to a God who wants to provide all of our needs in himself. Again, not because the things are bad, but because those things only point to him who has created those things, given us those things. So here's some application points to embrace calm and quiet, like the psalmist said when he says that he calmed and quieted himself. Here's a few things I'd love for you to take away even this week. One, reject that which is breeding addiction in you. Reject those things that become so habitual that you just always run to for comfort. The things that you almost don't think about anymore. Right? For some of us, it's food. For some of us, it's substances. For most of us, it's our phone. It's social media. It's, I can't do without this thing. Maybe it's time to have some phone-free evenings, some phone-free weekends, some times where you're not comparing yourself on Instagram and Facebook and everything else, some times where you just say, I'm going to be quiet, and I don't need my phone on. I don't need Netflix to be going on. For some of us, it's stop looking at all the ads. Stop looking at the things that are telling you you need more. Throw out the catalog. Stop going online and looking at the stuff that just tells you, you need more, more, more. This will satisfy. This is, do away with it. Stop looking at it. Voluntarily curb some of your appetites. Yeah, I want to do that. I want to experience that. I want to see that. Voluntarily say, you know what? I don't think that's going to lead me to where nobody's going to make me, but I'm just going to stop. I'm not going to watch that, see that, go there, do that, think that way. Reject anything that's breeding addiction in you. Secondly, look for opportunities to give rather than receive. this is, you know, okay, cliche Christmas time, right? It's better to give than receive, blah, blah, blah. But look for those opportunities. Most of us have goals in what we want to receive, what we want to get at our job, in our finances, maybe with relationships. This is what I want to get. But maybe turn that around. Look for opportunities to give rather than receive. Have giving goals instead of accumulating goals. Whether that's stuff, whether it's recognition, some of us is like, I need everybody to want me, like me, need me, tell me how great I am. Maybe if you turn that around and say, today, I'm going to try and bless 10 people by telling them that I appreciate them, I care about them, that they're doing a good job. Just flip that around instead of making it all about you. Even achievement. Help other people, lift them up so that they can succeed instead of always focusing on just what you need to do to get where you need to go. Help somebody else get there. Help somebody else achieve. And then third, and maybe most importantly, schedule time to be quiet with God. Put it in your schedule and protect it with the fierceness of your most important appointments of the week, because it is. If you're married, if you have kids, you're probably going to work with your spouse on this. You have to trade off a little. Say, hey, listen, I need my half hour, I need my hour, and we'll switch, but this is important, and we need to do this for our souls. We need to get quiet. Do things like reflect on the health of your soul. Think about what God is teaching you through the scriptures. Meditate on those scriptures. Pray for wisdom. Pray for the people around you. Spend time not doing anything except appreciating God and his character, what he has done in your life. And if you have kids, again, one of the best things you can model for your kids is a healthy soul to say, I'm going to figure this out, and I'm going to make sure that I have times where I'm working on my soul. I'm spending time with God. I'm growing quiet and calm. Literally, those words mean to lay smooth and grow dumb. Or the way we might say it, sit down and shut up. Just find a quiet place. No playlist, no Netflix, no laptop, no phone. Just be with God. Allow your roots to drive towards him, to find that way deep down satisfaction. My family once gave me a gift when I graduated from seminary. It's one of those kind of priceless sentimental gifts. It's a Bible. It was my dad's Bible. And they gave it to me when I started in ministry, finished seminary. And I was looking through it after that. It was special. And I stopped on this one page because there's this little note in the margin. It says, Thanksgiving 01. And I stopped there because I remember Thanksgiving 01. Thanksgiving 01 was about a month before my dad died. He'd been working through procedures for cancer, for leukemia. And I actually remember that weekend because I actually remember the conversation that I had with him that weekend when I visited him in the hospital. So it was Thanksgiving weekend, 2001. And I remember that they were bringing out food to everybody, and it was turkey. I mean, it was hospital version of turkey, but it was turkey. And you could smell it. You could smell the gravy. You could smell the turkey. You could smell all those, you know, Thanksgiving smells that many of us experience at Thanksgiving time. It was just, even though it was the hospital food, I would love to have that. And Thanksgiving 2001, my dad couldn't eat because of all the procedures, because of what he had been through. He was on a feeding tube. And yet his stomach was anticipating food. And so his stomach had those pains that you get when you haven't eaten for a really, really long time. And it was turning over because his stomach wanted to work and digestion like it does, even though he hadn't been able to eat. And so beside a couple of verses, you wrote Thanksgiving 01. This is what it says. It's from Psalm 63. My soul will be satisfied as with the richest of foods. With singing lips, my mouth will praise you. On my bed, I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night because you are my help. I sing in the shadow of your wings. My soul clings to you, and your right hand upholds me. See, sometimes it's the absence of a bunch of things that we want that our souls are most free to appreciate the presence of God. Our souls become quiet enough to hear his voice and to sense his powerful fulfillment. A God who wants to feed us more than food, more than superficial things. A God who wants to draw our roots deep down to the very source of life. Would you lay smooth and grow dumb. Calm yourself and be quiet. And in those moments, I hope and I pray for you that you might experience a deep connection of your soul to the one who loves and fulfills your very deepest longings. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, this is almost too deep for us to understand in some ways. Our needs and desires sometimes are so much louder than they should be. God, today I pray that you'd give each of us a quiet within us, a quiet that allows us to stand before you, sit before you. And as we quiet all those desires and those voices, maybe as we voluntarily curb some of those appetites, God, I pray that you would reveal yourself to us to be the source of real love, the source of real relationship, the source of self-esteem, the source of self-confidence, the source of our identity. And God, would we be able to drink deeply the satisfying waters of life that are found in you? Thank you, God, for all the good things in this world that we desire, but would you help us to keep them in perspective and to never worship what's created, but instead to draw close to you, our Creator. We thank you and we love you in Christ's name. Amen.